You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated...
It is Thursday, December 15th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Excuse me. Today on the program, Chris Cobb. From Occupy Wall Street. He's the guy with the fake Fox News camera who is held a press conference the other day at the base of Wall Street to celebrate the 300th anniversary of the opening of the slave trade in the United States, which took place, coincidentally enough, or not, on Wall Street. Also on the program today, Jeff Smith, don't be a putz, straight out of jail. Just got off the chain gang. At least a 38-hour ordeal for basically having the audacity to live stream a protest. Or live tweet it, I should say. We'll talk to Jeff also on the program today. The NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act. We talked about it with Spencer Ackerman on Monday of this week. At the end of that conversation of talking about how horrible it is, Spencer said the president had vowed to veto the bill. Well,
surprise, surprise.
Not so much anymore. We will discuss it on the program today if I can manage to talk about it without getting too pissed off and depressed. Senator Ron Wyden and Congressman Paul Ryan talk about their plan for Medicare. A huge shift for Ryan, who, of course, is the lead negotiator on Medicare. And Ron Wyden, you know, some members of Senate are a little bit crazy. We'll talk about that program just so you understand how sort of sad and pathetic it is. It has more political implications than policy implications at this point. And more. We'll finally get to that Lowe's story. And tomorrow on the program, we'll be joined by, in addition to Cliff Schechter. Is there a debate tonight?
There is, yes.
Oh,
I believe
right. We'll
it's
talk
the last
about the
debate of the year.
No, well, yeah, okay, thank God. I mean, we're only a week and a half away from the end of the year. We'll be talking to Cliff Schechter, and also giving us the movie reviews tomorrow will be Asif Manvi, whom you probably know from Beat Cops, the pilot I did and cast him in 12 years ago, or what's that other, The Daily Show. Yeah, you can do it on The Daily Show. So just a little bit of house cleaning. First off, I want to give a huge, huge thank you to whom we referred to as Sinclair, who has bequeathed the show The Sinclair, the 17-inch MacBook Pro that has been perhaps the main driver. That thing has been passed around this office in so many different ways, and has served so many different functions for us. A week ago, we mentioned that when we turned on – have we posted that video?
You haven't sent it to me yet.
The video of the Sinclair sounding like it was about to explode upon launch. And then literally within hours, Sinclair, who bequeathed us Sinclair, sent us Sinclair 2, a wonderful refurbed Mac Mini, which is now in the process of being integrated into the Borg. That is the Majority Report. So a huge thank you to Sinclair, not only for Sinclair 1, but for Sinclair 2, too.
This person has changed my perspective on people named Sinclair. I always felt like it was a very evil villain sounding name, Sinclair. Like, you know, like a big, like, you know, whatever.
High on a hill was a lonely goat herd, lay, herd, lay.
And we have an email from listener Tolbert. Great new website, much easier to use with the iPhone. It keeps me logged on between shows and much easier to play, pause, forward, and reverse. The previous website did not work as well on the iPhone, but I am not a complainer. Your interview with David Graeber on 1212 was excellent. We think we have it all figured out, but we are just repeating our ancestors' mistakes. He is direct and clear, and my daughter is getting me the book for Christmas. Thanks, Sam. I was one of the first subscribers to the show, and I've been a devoted listener from years, from the Air America days. Well, sir, thank you. And I should just remind people before we go to the break that we are having some problems with Internet Explorer 8, it appears, for people listening to live shows. So if you've experienced that same problem, please email us at majorityreporters@gmail.com. We are checking with our compliance department as we speak. One final note, as one of the bills that we've been talking about on this program is SOPA, and it looks like it's not going to come up for a vote this year, which is good news because it becomes harder the closer we get to an election to pass something like this. It is a horrible bill that has some very unfortunate supporters from my perspective, progressives, including Al Franken. But there was an interesting piece in the Huffington Post by Justice Zach Thomas, I think it was. And he did make one note that stuck out for me. We've talked about SOPA many times on this program, multiple times, not many times, but at least a couple of times. But he writes, NBC Universal is one of the multiple television behemoths lobbying in support of the bill, as is News Corp, the parent company for both Fox Pictures and Fox News. In the past 6 months, Fox News, Fox Business, not surprising, but MSNBC and CNBC have remained silent on Protect IP and SOPA. According to a HuffPost review of cable TV records. So I just raised that issue. It jumped out at me. So, you know, when I get on and I, you know, request members from you, understand this is a new business model. I have people who complain to me like, how come you don't offer the same rates as a radio show? Well, because we're not a radio show. We don't have radio revenue. And we are simply, we are funded exclusively by members. And we keep the first 40 minutes of the show free because we want to expand our audience. And basically for technical reasons. I don't want to get to the point where we have to make it just 20 minutes and it's just a slight preview. That's a model that is out there, but I don't want to do that. But we do need members, folks. We need members at a significantly quicker rate than we're getting now. But we may play around with things in the near future. The David Graeber interview, we cut off. We got some new members from that, and maybe that's the way that we need to go. But I would rather not. I would rather just rely on the kindness of strangers. That said, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll be talking to Chris Cobb later in the program. Don't be a putz, and a breakdown of this NDAA cave. We'll be right back in just a moment.
all presidents, we're all congressmen, we're all cops. And waiting were the workers of the world. There is the elite and the dispossessed, and it's only about survival. Who has skill to play the game for all it's worth? Reaching up, scared kind of perfection. Let's try and keep as much emotion out of this as possible. Let's try not to remember any names. We'll do it for a country, for a people, for more vision. United will make them remember our history.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. On the phone, artist and writer and faux Fox News cameraman, Chris Cobb. He has just recently launched OccupyPublishing.org. And this project that he is going to be talking about us today is run through that site. Welcome to the program, Chris.
Thanks, Sam.
Hi, Chris. I'm sorry. You there?
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yeah. We're breaking up just a little bit, but we should be okay. Now, okay. So, Chris, I read the piece on Huffington Post, but tell me what this project is.
Can you hear me better now?
Yeah.
Okay. Occupying.org is a website I just started up. Because I realized that there are a lot of stories that weren't being told in the Occupy movement. And I couldn't help but notice when you walk down Wall Street and you look at signs about the famous buildings and about all of the architects, and all the bankers and the history of the financial industry, I couldn't help but notice there's no mention of the word slave or slavery in any sign up and down Wall Street. And I was doing research for OccupyPublishing.org for a project. I realized that December 13th, 1711 was the anniversary, was the date when the first Common Council, the ancestor of the City Council, that was the date that they actually created the first slave market. And it was on Wall Street and Water Street. And I thought, wow, that's 300 years ago, and that was yesterday, or the day before now, and that's 300 years ago, that anniversary exists, and there's still not a single sign anywhere around Lower Manhattan about the slave trade and its impact on Wall Street and New York. And I thought, maybe this is something I should create a campaign about to get signage for.
Yeah, and so you've got now, my understanding is you have over 5,000, or you're headed for 5,000 people to sign a petition. Is that the goal here?
Yeah, that's correct.
And people can find that at OccupyPublishing.org. Well, so tell me, I mean, it wasn't a coincidence that the slave trade, those first auctions happened on Wall Street, was it?
No, it was actually apparently New York. New York was.
We're going to have to call you back. I'm going to call you, Chris. Can you hear me? We're going to call you back on. We're going to call you back on a phone. I'll be right. We'll try in a second. We'll be right back. Okay, Chris. I was asking you. It's not a coincidence that the slave trade started on Wall Street, was it?
No, actually, it's a little known fact, but New York was considered the capital of slavery in the North, and during the colonial era, one in five people who lived in New York was actually an enslaved African. One in five. So this was where a lot of the slave ships had come up the East River from the Caribbean or from Africa, and it was a central point to sell slaves to the rest of North America, and they did it right where Wall Street meets the East River.
It's interesting, and was sort of the beginning of Wall Street becoming such an important financial center.
It was. Apparently, it was quite profitable because not only were people on Wall Street making money off of selling women and children and enslaved men, but they were also investing heavily in the ships and shipbuilding industry, because there were over 40,000 ships that were involved in the transatlantic slave trade, and that was big money.
And so, to a certain extent, Wall Street functioning then like it functions now, insofar as, well, I guess I should say at that time it was providing capital to produce a product or to bring a product to market. In that case, it was human beings, but it had the same sort of, capacity to ignore the human suffering involved in its raising those funds.
Well, yeah, exactly. A good example of that, I would say, is that, back in the colonial era, there is a form of utopian capitalism, the kind that was about getting the lowest possible price for a worker. You just pay as little as you can for a worker, and then the product you get is going to be produced by that slave labor. And so actually all the products like butter or indigo, which is a dye, or, all kinds of things like sugar, all kinds of products, coffee, that the colonists used up and actually the Europeans used up, were produced by slave labor. So that was the entire supply chain, if you will, of products and services. They're all produced by this really, really cheap labor. That resonates now because to some degree that happens in other countries, and it's still, it's one of the things that human beings do to each other.
And I guess also to a certain extent we see that mentality in terms of labor being one of those things that or the cost of labor is an ultimate a big part of the agenda that we see today, which is that has existed probably for 30 some odd years, to drive down the costs of labor and to basically put those profits in the pockets of the financiers.
Well, yeah, exactly. If you want to look at how prevalent it is, just if you're familiar with the story of Jack Abramov, the lobbyist who is arrested and put away, and he just came out with a new book. When he started making money, one of the first things he did was he got some investors together, and they basically bought a sweatshop off of American soil. Is it the Mariana Islands?
Yes, I think it's Saipan, is it? In the Mariana Islands.
Yeah, and the first thing he did was he got a bunch of investors together, and they invested in the sweatshop labor because they could make a lot of money off of these people, and there's no regulations to prevent them from working these people to death. As soon as he made enough money, that's where he put his money, because there's big money in exploiting the labor of other people.
Yeah, and I seem to remember that Tom DeLay had a nice visit to the Mariana Islands, and they were looking at this as a model, perhaps, for the way that America could run as well, if I'm not mistaken. All right. Well, it's interesting because in the course of reading about your press conference that you held down in Wall Street to announce this project to get some type of record that the first slave auction was held where it was held in New York and in the country, I guess. I didn't realize that there was so many slaves that were buried essentially under that part of Manhattan.
Right. That's another untold story that OccupyPublishing.org hopes to kind of spread out and educate people about. Is the in 1989 when they were digging they're breaking ground on a new federal building on Broadway, just a few blocks north of Zuccotti Park, actually, they discovered human remains. And when they brought archaeologists in, they discovered that these remains were of black folks. And as they looked, they found that there's an estimated 15,000 to 20,000 black folks that were buried there, and it was known as the Negro Burial Ground for years. And because only blacks were buried there from New York for about 100 years, I think, that's where they went when they died. They were buried there. And apparently it was a long-forgotten plot of land, and Lower Manhattan was built on top of it. So actually, the ugly truth is that a lot of Lower Manhattan is built on a graveyard, you know, between City Hall and Wall Street. There's potentially thousands of dead black folks still buried under there, and nobody knows about it. And in a weird way, it's desecration. And I think that it's a good time, you know, especially with Occupy Wall Street, it's a good time to start recognizing the contributions that these people made, even against their will. You know, they built the first City Hall. You know, they built the wall that Wall Street is named after. So, you know, I think that that's important to recognize.
You know, it's fascinating because, and for the life of me, I cannot remember. I did a couple of interviews for Ring of Fire yesterday, so I can't remember who it is that told me this or I read. But you know, one of the big things that instigated the Powell memo, which has brought about sort of this wave of corporatization that we have seen in the modern era, and the power of corporations, particularly obviously when he became a Supreme Court justice and led the court in a couple of very important 5-4 decisions. But the catalyst for Powell was the social emancipation of essentially blacks and of women in many respects, and their entry into the workforce in as full citizens, the pressure this put on just the system, and the corporations striking back. I mean, so this very it's fascinating. This story that Occupy Publishing is telling us about. All right, let us know. We just got a minute left or so. But what else do you plan to do with Occupy Publishing?
Well, one of the things that has come up a lot in the Occupy movement is issues of diversity and race. And I just wanted to put it out there that before the nationally coordinated raids on all the camps, that was a big topic, and that was the time when we were kind of working out theory. And I think that now you're seeing a time of actions. And, you know, the ports were shut down the other day on the West Coast, and I think it's an interesting analog that over here, this thing that we're doing, I mean, it's mostly my project, but a lot of the people in the arts and culture and Occupy movement here are in support of it. But, you know, the port here that used to deal with the transatlantic slave trade, it's in the past, but bringing it to recognition now is a counterpoint to what they're doing on the West Coast. So I think that's an interesting kind of thing to mull over.
Do you think that Bloomberg would ever do this? I mean, how would you go about? In other words, who do you deliver this petition to? Is there a historical society that might actually be to have some independence, some capacity to do it? Is it perhaps a private entity that would put the plaque on their building? I mean, who do you aim at?
Well, thank you for asking that. I forgot to mention it. Well, at the press conference on December 13th, Councilman Jumaane Williams came, and both he and Adonis Rodriguez and Letitia James, all city council members, were in support of this but couldn't make it. Only Jumaane Williams could. And he said he'd be interested in getting a co-sponsor or two to draft legislation for the city council to consider. His staff told me that would probably happen sometime in January, that process. So until then, I'm going to be the cheerleader for this and try to move this forward generate interest by visiting various institutions and hopefully maybe talk about the issue, because it's something not a lot of people know about.
Fantastic. Well, Chris Cobb, it's a fascinating project. It's a really interesting piece of history. And people can check out and support what you're doing at OccupyPublishing.org, OccupyPublishing.org. Chris, really appreciate the time today.
Okay, thank you, Sam.
Thank you, Chris. All right, folks, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Jeff Smith, Don't Be a Putz, on his 37-hour ordeal. Why did he get arrested? Why did they ask him to have a retina scan? Did he come out with eyeglasses? Did he get new glasses? Is that part of the program now where you go in, they give you a medical, they give you free eye care, dental work? We'll see when we come back right after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Jeff Smith from the media group of Occupy Wall Street. You may also know him as Don't Be a Putz. Jeff, once again, a free man. Welcome back.
Thanks a lot, Sam.
So, all right. So tell us. So you were at the Winter Garden at the World Financial Center. There was a sort of a spontaneous after the Goldman Sachs squid protest. There was a sort of a spontaneous protest against Brookfield. What happened?
Well, like you say, I mean, I wasn't even really sure that this was part of the plan. We had just finished doing a little scene of street theater in front of Goldman Sachs, and everything was calm, and the police were really respectful. And then, like you said, the group poured into the Winter Garden, which is a privately owned public space, actually one of the more beautiful indoor public spaces in New York City. It almost feels like a gilded shopping mall. And,
right. It looks like a big mall, sort of like it looked like people were protesting in sort of like the almost like it, you know, in some of those malls in the center where they have like a little, you know, where everybody gathers and sits around before they go to the TGIF or the Everything Pig store or whatever it is. So everybody's gathered in there.
Right. And so,
oh my God, the cops are sending the canine unit after you.
Yes. So we were in the Winter Garden and, It was actually one of the better sort of scenes that I've seen. I mean, there's been a lot of video of it, but it's literally people dancing in circles and chanting. It was quite loud, quite fun, quite boisterous. And it turned from a situation where people were just laughing and dancing within a span of about 4 to 5 minutes, where someone from Brookfield came out with a bullhorn and started announcing something that barely anybody could hear. In fact, I have video where I'm, you know, 5 feet in front of him, maybe 3 feet in front of him, and you can hear him. It's directional, so he's spinning around in a circle telling people, you know, it's funny because he literally says, you people are occupying this space illegally. You're being forced to leave. And then he would say, if you leave now, you will not be arrested. And so some people, as he spun around, only heard, you will not be arrested. So at that point, some people started running up the escalator, and so there was a group of about 30 people that moved up the escalator, and the cops cut off that avenue. And from there, the police started just sort of grabbing people indiscriminately. And so arrests just started to break out in sort of the bottom of the atrium there. And so I was just standing there filming the whole thing, trying to cover as much as I could. And eventually, yeah, I got pushed back a little bit beyond that perimeter. And then there's a split instance where the cops just say, you know, get out of here now, just move. They just start, you know, pushing people in every direction, and I was literally trying to run out when I got grabbed from behind by police and said, you know, we got you, you're going. And they told me explicitly that, you know, you guys are getting criminal trespass, which means you guys are going down process, not just released on a DAT.
A DAT? What is that?
Which is just basically a desk summons, so you don't actually have to go down to central booking and sit and wait for a judge, as opposed to just being released ahead of time, like a traffic ticket. So they intentionally, I think, wanted to make people stay, and it certainly seems like they intentionally targeted people that were journalists in some kind of a way.
Yeah,
if you had a camera.
I was going to say, you know, you say it's indiscriminate, but, you know, the interesting thing is, I think the video, I'm sure you've seen it by now, although I also imagine you've been doing a lot of sleeping, of Justin Weeds. There is, you know, there was, what, about 17 of you who were arrested?
Correct. It was 10 men and 7 women, and some were members of the band and had instruments, but virtually everyone else was an independent photographer or journalist or tweeter or live streamer, some kind of person involved in getting the message out.
And the fascinating thing is, now people have to understand, there was at least a couple of hundred people there. I mean, so it's not like there was 35 people and they got half of them. And you can see the video of Justin Weeds, and we'll put that on our homepage at Majority FM. And he is grabbed from behind. So he's not obviously getting into some cop's face. He's sitting there with a laptop. He's about as immobile as you could possibly be and still on your feet with a laptop in one hand and a camera in another. I assume he was sort of like doing one of those Bluetooth camera things to his computer as he was live streaming. And he's grabbed from behind and sort of just singled out. How much forethought do you think went into this by the cops? Or do they have like a standing order? I mean, what's your sense?
I don't know. I mean, you know, part of me thinks that maybe it was luck. But when you think about it, really, not only did it seem intentional, it blows my mind, because how dumb can you be to not only arrest us first thing in the morning, hold us all day and straight through the night into the next day, so the next day's news cycle is ready for it, and as you go into prime time of that next day to have us still being held, you know, and then on top of that, you arrest a bunch of media people that already know how to connect to the press and, you know, tweet out their stories, and, you know, that's why you ended up with live stream footage still coming out of the back of the paddy wagon and photographs. And, you know, down in the cell, I was able to call up a press number that we had that used Google Voice, and we recorded the conversations and then had those out before we were even out of the jail. So, you know, in many ways, it almost became a press opportunity for us. And it just sort of points again to the just sort of ineptitude in some way with the way Bloomberg and these guys seem to be handling it. And I say Bloomberg because when we finally 14 hours later showed up at Central Booking, the first thing we heard was a phone, you know, picked up, and the woman said, you know, yeah, the protesters are here. So there's somebody obviously, you know, watching us through this whole system and treating this thing separately.
Now, what is this story? And I read Kneffel. Is that how he pronounces his name?
Yeah, John Kneffel.
John Kneffel. I say Kneffel because of Milo's got a book, Kneffel Bunny, and it goes back and forth. It's a long story. He wrote a piece, I think it was in Salon, about the 37 hours that he was in there. I presume you spent more or less the same amount of time. What's this whole thing with the retina scan?
Well, it's you know, in addition to the fingerprints and mugshots, they also try and force you to do a retina scan, and I think they don't really tell you up front that it's optional, but, you know, most of us kind of knew that, and our lawyer confirmed that. So when we came in, virtually all of us declined to do the retina scan. But at the very end of the process, after we had been waiting, after seeing our lawyer for, you know, 4 or 5 hours, when we were finally about to go see the judge, they tried to force us once again to submit to this retina scan. And so you know, one by one, people were, you know, going in and refusing and then getting put back in. And finally they came out and said, hey, listen, if none of you guys are going to submit to it, just tell us now. And the end result was, you know, basically they were saying you're going to have to spend another night in jail if you don't do this optional retinal scan. And when we talked to our lawyer, she said, you know, since they've been doing this for about 2 years, I don't think anybody has really refused them, certainly not in a big number like this. So this may be potentially an important case if you guys want to do it. And there were, on the women's side, there was actually only one woman who was 18 years old, and she was refusing adamantly while the others were fine to do it. And then once the men, you know, weighed it amongst ourselves, it was virtually all of us decided that we would go ahead and refuse and stay another night if we had to. So in the end, what happened was the judge backed down, I guess, and they decided to just let us go. But I was certainly willing to spend one more night to not have to, you know, finally submit one more time to this police state, you know, and for fear of punishment. I mean, that's what it feels like. They're just desensitizing you, training you to submit to whatever kind of procedure they want to do to you, to catalog you and, you know, keep track of you.
Wow. But I presume though that, you know, just like, when you go to the eye doctor, you do the retina scan, they give you a lollipop, right? Or something like that. Don't they give you, you get a little toy or something? Well, that's good. So, you all refused en masse and they backed down from their threat to hold you.
Correct. But they were, I mean, when the first person that went in and refused, the bailiff told him, you know, fine, see you in a week, douchebag, as he walked back towards the jail cell. And they technically have the right to hold you for 72 hours from the point at which you reach central booking, which for us would have been until, like, you know, early Friday morning. So
Wow. It
was, you know, kind of a threat. But again, I mean, you know, I'm in a position where I'm willing to do that at this point, you know, because when we start giving up these rights, I mean, forget about prosecuting Wall Street. We're talking about having no more First Amendment rights. Journalists can't even, you know, do their job. We're really seeing such an incredible backlash to these protests that I think, hopefully, I really think this might make the protest even more successful, because people will see that this is not a joke. When you start telling the truth to power and they react this way, it's pretty much confirmation that what we're doing is really effective.
Yeah, I think, I mean, there's a lot of things that the occupation and the direct actions have been revealing, I think, both in terms of the specific issues that they're addressing, you know, whether it's a foreclosure or stop and frisk or union busting or whatever the direct actions have been about. But then there's these ancillary aspects where it shows, you know, just the militarization of our police and the infringement upon our First Amendment rights and a whole other slew of rights. And, of course, you get out today and you hear that the president won't be vetoing this NDAA, this National Defense Authorization Act, which, you know, once the protests get classified as low-level terrorists, then you can just be held indefinitely, retinal scan or not, at that point. But my understanding is that today there was some action taking place. I don't know if it was an official Occupy Wall Street action to the extent, but that according to OccupyWallStreet.org, there's a Defend the Bill of Rights for All of Us press conference today that took place just an hour ago on the streets of the federal court in Foley Square. But tell us what you know about what's planned for Saturday, which is the 3-month anniversary of Occupy Wall Street.
Okay. And by the way, the proceedings at Foley Square actually also included a funeral procession for the Bill of Rights, and there was a coffin and pallbearers, and so we also were celebrating, so to speak, or, you know, paying our respects to what used to be our great nation's laws. So as far as D-17 coming up, we are, you know, when we say that we're reoccupying the space, really it's more about trying to bring a large group of people there. There's going to be events going on. You will see tents erected and the so-called tenting exhibition where artists are going to be drawing murals and painting on them. So that allows us to be able to erect tents for an art space. And then I believe there's also going to be a concert that's happening as well. I know that Patti Smith is confirmed. Not sure if there will be other artists as well. So there's going to be music there. And we also have members of the clergy that are basically willing to step up and be the first ones onto the property to say we want Trinity Church to allow us to use this space to build another camp and do something similar. It would be a different sort of situation than Zuccotti because it's a private space, and so with their permission, it would allow us to set up some certain guide rules and build a map of the space and the way that we're going to plan it and be very explicit about what we want to do there and use it as just an outreach center and, you know, some of the similar things we did at Zuccotti. So what we're saying to Trinity Church is that, you know, if you're willing to arrest your own members and the first man over the fence is going to be a bishop of the Episcopal Church, a decorated war hero, and we're going to see what they do. I mean, Trinity Church is the third largest real estate holder in New York City. The land that the New York Stock Exchange sits on is owned by Trinity Church, and this piece of land that's been undeveloped at Duarte Square, 6th and Canal, has been there empty for several years, and it was originally given to Trinity Church by Queen Anne, I think, in the late 16th century. And so we really feel like that it's the church's decision to decide whether they want to fight for charity or for justice. And, you know, churches do a lot of charity work, and they claim they've helped us out, you know, in some ways, let us use some of their spaces. But I also feel like corporations do charity. You know, there's lots of rich people that do so-called charity, but fighting for justice is a totally different thing. And that's really what we want. And I think what a lot of members of the church feel like, you know, there's so many pundits and journalists and you know, former prosecutors that have felt like they've been on the outside of so many discussions, and Occupy Wall Street has moved it back towards the place that has put them in the center. And I think a certain degree, the radical clergy is the same way. That the people that have actually been fighting for poor people and justice and so much of the oppression in the world have felt like they've been marginalized within the church. And so this is, again, another opportunity, I think, to take another group and put pressure on another entity that has, frankly, turned into the same. I mean, it's sad to say that there are churches that have so much money and wealth that they operate like corporations, but it seems to be true. So this is going to be the next step, and what we hope is that it will be replicable. I mean, even if this is a success, we know that we'll need more spaces throughout New York and to keep doing this. So this is the next project, and I think whatever happens, I think we'll, as always, we try everything that we do to be sort of win-win scenario.
Right.
So even if the police, you know, fight back against us and there's pictures of clergy in their robes being led away in handcuffs, I think it will make our point. So I'm hoping that for once they figure out this PR game and let us have our First Amendment right. I mean, that's really the only best way I think they can handle this is just to accept what we have to say and let us have our First Amendment right, because it's really not what we're doing, it's what we're saying. That's what they hate. All these activities would be totally condoned if we were out there celebrating the New York Stock Exchange. If we were, you know, we're not leaving till the Dow hits 20,000, you know,
right.
They'd be like, how many porta potties do you need?
Exactly. All right. Well, Jeff Smith, D17 is at 12 p.m. at Duarte Square Park, which is at 6th Avenue and Canal in New York City. You know, we'll talk to you next week about what went down. Down there, and people should check it out. D17, the 3-month anniversary of Occupy Wall Street. And Jeff, glad you made it through your 37-hour ordeal safely. We've got the picture. You're looking pretty badass. I got to be honest with you on the picture of your perp walk.
Yeah, probably only surpassed by my mugshot. I wonder if I can get a hold of that. I'll have to.
They don't give you copies of that?
No. I mean, is that how they used to work? I don't know. I guess it's a dual-edged sword if you get that out on the internet. You want your mugshot on the internet?
Right. Well, that's why you always got to smile. That's what Tom DeLay taught us all. Jeff Smith, thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate talking to you, buddy.
All right, thanks. Bye.
Bye. All right, folks. Now we shall head into the better half of the program, where I will summon all of my optimism and cheeriness to talk about the National Defense Authorization Act of 2012. You know, as Spencer Ackerman said, the good news is the military is not obligated, if you are unilaterally deemed to be a terrorist of some sort, it's not obligated to hold you indefinitely. It's just that now the president can say, yes, the military can hold you indefinitely, as opposed to just having to automatically do it. And so, you know, that's a positive. You know, I'm sure President Obama, who was willing to authorize the unilateral decision to assassinate an American citizen because of his YouTubes, or, you know, President Gingrich or Perry or Romney or Bachman, sure, they will be very judicious in their use of their unilateral decision as to whether or not you as an American citizen or any citizen can be held indefinitely. When we come back in the better half, I'll explain why this is actually a change, despite the fact that we've been doing much of this already. We'll be right back after this. Again, if you can become a member, please do. You can support the show by going to justcoffee.coop, getting organic coffee, tea, chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY to get a 10% discount. We got merch for sale. Please give us a review on iTunes. If you buy crap through Amazon, use our link under the support the show at majority.fm. And come to the open thread today on majority.fm. Tell us what you want as a best of show. What are the best three interviews or segments, you can say that, from the year? And you decide, ladies and gentlemen. See you in the better half.